With your permission, we'd like to talk shop for just a moment.
Because we've got a good racket going, you're not going to be able to touch our own.
Oh, okay, so you've got a racket going.
Cookies are not the only food. I tell that to my children all the time.
It's time for the Publisher Fight. It's time for the Publisher Fight.
Here's a man that really appreciates that new England power.
Hi, how's it going? And welcome to the BBC Podcast. My name is Vincent Plug. I'm the editor-in-chief at BBC. We're about to kick off a new season of the podcast, so I hope to be posting episodes a bit more regularly in 2022. We've been extremely busy at Video Week. We're going to be expanding our event offering quite a bit this year. The first of which will be New Video Frontiers, our flagship conference in London. That's going to be taking place at King's Place on April 28th. This is going to be our biggest New Video Frontiers ever. We'll be expanding the conference into an additional hall. Part of the rationale for that is we want to be able to provide a space for some of the emerging areas, things like Metaverse and Web 3.0, which it's difficult to cram everything into the main stage. So yeah, we think between two halls we'll be able to sort of cover everything. Tickets for that one are available at newvideofrontiers.com. This week's episode is with Alex Kahn. Alex is the Group MD for International at Unruly. Unruly are probably a company I think most listeners in the video space will already be familiar with, but if you aren't familiar with them, they're one of the companies who are probably best known at the moment for their Outstream offering, but the company is very much video at its core and believes that, you know, much of the future growth in video will come from CTV. Alex has had a very interesting career, working mostly in video, but he has dipped in and out of other areas, which I think is always a healthy thing for people to do. Okay, so now I'll cross over to my conversation with Alex, and I hope you'll enjoy. So, Alex, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here, Vincent.
No, great to have you. So how did you come to be in ad tech? It's a question I ask sort of most guests, and I always think it's an interesting one. I don't think many careers advisors were pushing us into ad tech careers at school. So yeah, how did you come to be on this side of the industry?
Yeah, it's I guess like many people, it's a convoluted story. I actually started off doing a friend of mine a favor who was who got a job as a recruitment consultant, and he needed to fill in places at a graduate recruitment session for a company called VNU. And so he asked if he could put my CV in, and he put my CV in, and I went along to the interview so that he could hit his quota target. And I actually got the job. So I ended up selling display magazine advertising for hard copy magazines. And that was a great learning curve. It taught me how to deal with various people, taught me great phone skills, which comes in handy in times of COVID. And really kind of set me on the path to my career in media and advertising. And then from there, I went and joined Dennis Publishing. And then from Dennis, I went to a company called Silicon.com, who were basically a cross between Reuters and CNN. And it was designed to be a specialist technology news service for clients who really wanted to understand about specific topics related to them. And we had 11, I think it was 11 channels. Might have been a
Is
bit
Is
it
11
more.
Like video channels?
They were channels that they were combination. This is the interesting thing. Even way back then in the late 90s, early 2000s, it was a combination of text and video. So we would have guests come into our TV studios. And in those days, you needed a fully digitized TV studio, and they would come in and we would do Q&As, and we had a staff of around 100 reporters, and they would do the article. The video interview would be placed within the article, and then certain brands or the brand that was being covered would do the sponsorship. So as part of the commercial team, I ended up selling sponsorship packages to all manner of companies. From Oracle to what was then in those days known as Deck Computing, to Dell, to anyone that was involved in technology, really. And that kind of struck my interest, piqued my interest in this whole kind of growth area around the internet. And in those days, It was all about Yahoo and MSN. It wasn't Google was just a speck on the horizon. And we were, it was really kind of an area that a lot of marketers were showing a great deal of interest in. So unfortunately, we were scheduled to IPO, but the in 2000, but the great fall of 2000 scuppered that. And that was my first experience of the high of being in a pre-IPO to the low of being in a, we've got to start building everything again. But equally, as I said, it piqued my interest. And I ended up then moving to Yahoo, where I ran the agency sales team at Yahoo and got really involved in mainstream digital advertising. And that's where my, I guess, my real kind of knowledge and hands-on experience of ad tech started there. And really that was kind of a great experience, and really enjoyed the fact that we were able to build addressable packages out to for marketeers to specific audiences. And yeah, that was that's where my focus on ad tech started.
And you worked out in APAC at one point. Which company was where you? Yeah, who are you working with out in APAC?
Sure. So when I first went to APAC, I just recently left Yahoo and I joined a company called Deal Group Media, who are listed on the AIM as their global head of commercial. And at that time, the reason why I joined is because I wanted to get a bigger understanding of affiliate marketing. Which is basically performance-driven marketing or commission-based performance marketing on the internet. And I wanted to understand more about that. So I joined the company, bought my skills and knowledge from running mainstream sponsorship and brand advertising campaigns from Silicon and Yahoo. And we created an old-school ad network business to complement our affiliate business. And with the rise of that affiliate business and growing competition from companies like TradeDoubler and certain US firms, we looked at new areas where we could satisfy not only our goals and aspirations, but our shareholders' expectations. And so Asia looked like a logical next step. And we already had a business in Australia that was thriving and doing very well. We had a business in India that was doing very well. And so in order to kind of connect those three areas, London, Delhi, and Sydney, we looked at, originally we were looking at Hong Kong. But then on the way back from a business trip in Australia, we stopped off at Singapore, had a meeting there with a few prospective clients, and decided that Singapore would be a better hub for us. So I ended up moving to Singapore to set up our business there, and to really try and establish what we could do from a ad network stroke affiliate search marketing business with Singapore as a hub. And I ended up, I was originally meant to go for 2 years and I ended up staying 15.
Wow. It's, and what was it like working out there? I mean, I always find that market fascinating because, I mean, if you look at, you know, Europe, for example, you know, you've got relatively, you know, it's relatively on a similar level of economic development. Sure, you've got the languages and business culture differences, but I think APAC just looks like another level of complexity, even in terms of the spread of the companies. So how does APAC function as a kind of regional market, and how is it different to other markets?
Yeah, it's I guess the key thing that anyone who is looking to go and work in Asia or does indeed already work in Asia, the key thing you'll know and soon realize is it's very fragmented. The difference between doing business, if you look at the core main areas, let's not even bring China in for the moment, but if you look at Japan, that has its own ecosystem, very traditional business. You then go down to Australia, which is a bit more freewheeling, easier because it's English speaking. And then you have the hub in Singapore, which is both time-wise and probably geographically, pretty much in the middle. And so you kind of have the fragmentation of Southeast Asia there, where you've got multiple countries that each have their own languages, each have their own cultures, and you need to be able to handle diverse cultures and understandings, and not every market accelerates at the same time. And so or has the same capabilities. For example, some markets are quite risk adverse, some markets are all for testing and embracing new developments. And so that's what makes it exciting and great. Particularly at that time, I was involved in a region that provided everything from new and growing markets through to large established markets that were pretty much on the same level of development as the European markets. And it was a great ride. And the time there was very, how can I say, very fulfilling for me. I went out to set up an ad network and affiliate business. And then through that, I ended up working for one of Malaysia or Southeast Asia's largest publishers and took their entire magazine portfolio digital. And then we ended up listing that business on the Malaysian Stock Exchange. That was a hugely rewarding and exciting time and great, great experience for me. From there, I joined a company called AdaptTV, which was my first proper foray into fully fledged programmatic ad tech, where they were one of the US's largest programmatic video platforms. And right at the time that I joined them, they were acquired by AOL, who were making a more concerted push, already well established in Australia, well established in Japan, and wanted to understand, had a reasonable business in China as well, wanted to take advantage of those three locations and build out into the rest of Asia. So I ended up then working for AOL and over the course of my career with them, which was hugely rewarding because I managed to get involved in acquisitions, in new office openings, was able to learn a huge amount around being multicultural and learning to deal with all those different cultures and the fragmentation of the markets. I ended up running the AOL business in Asia Pacific for several years. So it's at that point you begin to see how fast and how quickly ad tech has grown. And I think that's why a lot of people stay in it, because it is exciting. And once you understand the principles, there is a huge amount of growth and learning and interest you can get from it.
Yeah, it doesn't stay still ever, I think. It's to a surprising degree. You know, I think if you went back to me 15 years ago and said that you were going to be fascinated by ad technology and the different shifts that are happening, I would have thought you were a liar. But yeah, still here. AdaptTV were our first ever sponsor as well for our first event many years ago, and eternally grateful to that company. It'd be good to chat a bit about your rollout on Unruly, but also it might be helpful if you sort of explain, you know, firstly what Unruly, what they do. I think there might be some listeners who aren't familiar with them, but also then maybe to put them in the wider context that you're part of the Tremor International group, and to maybe explain what other companies are in that group and the sort of relationship between the different companies.
Yeah, so back in January 2020, Tremor International bought Unruly from News Corp. Tremor International, for those who don't know, is an ad technology platform business. It mainly based in the US and provides a lot of managed services around multi-format video. The acquisition of Unruly enabled them to provide, and that's done through an in-house DSP platform that was specifically built to drive campaigns through video partners, supply partners, and exchanges. And what Unruly did was enable them to basically purchase an SSP that could then take advantage of the technology stack that Tremor gave and bought with them, and enabled Unruly to move away from being a specialist in outstream video delivery to multi-format video across multiple markets at scale, including the ability to start building out and growing an advanced TV or for more common terms, CTV and OTT delivery. And so really Tremor International is the holding group brand And then in the US, we have two brands. We have Tremor Video, which looks after a managed service business. We have Unruly, which looks after our programmatic business. And then international, we have Unruly, which is the main core brand. And that that effectively provides multiple service options to clients as an SSP. We can provide managed service. We can provide third-party service, i.e. we're connected to most major DSPs. And we are also able to provide self-service solutions where people can use white label SSP or white label version of the DSP.
So you mentioned Outstream there, and you know, I know we're going to be speaking mostly about CTV, but just before we do, what do you think has happened with Outstream? It felt like we were sort of talking about Outstream every other week for quite a few years, and the noise is certainly quietened down. And for me, from my perspective, I'll also tell you what I think. It sort of felt like, you know, we had this rush, we had this, okay, we've got this new source of video supply. Every publisher, you know, it seemed like almost every publisher was incorporating it into their sites, and then, you know, it's sort of fallen away. The ones who it's worked for have kept it, and the ones for whom didn't have you know, decided to pursue other sources of revenue. And if it has it plateaued, or what's happening in the Outstream side of things at the moment?
Yeah, I think plateaued is probably the right phrase for it. I think it's a misunderstood creative unit as well. You've hit the nail on the head. It was a new revenue source for publishers. It basically enabled mainstream publishers who were display-based to open up the option of video inventory, and therefore was a new revenue source for them. Is it the most enjoyable consumer experience? Again, I think the jury's out on that. But if the content is relevant to the consumer, then I think it's an experience that they'll enjoy, particularly if it provides ad-funded content that people don't necessarily have to subscribe to. And so I think it comes down to really the understanding of the advertiser as to what part Outstream plays in the overall ecosystem. As a standalone product, I get it. It might not be everyone's cup of tea, but as part of a multi-format video campaign, and by that I mean mobile in-app video all the way through to CTV and OTT, then I think it warrants a place on the schedule, because, hey, that's the whole point of being involved in ad tech and having KPI that enable platforms to make smart decisions and advertisers and agencies to make smart decisions. It should be part of the mix, and where it works, it should be embraced. And where it doesn't work, yes, of course, like anything else, it can be optimized out. But I do think it's a misunderstood creative unit that should be reconsidered as we move, or as we're now in 2022. I think it has a part to play.
Yeah, I remember actually it was somebody from Adapt TV once said to me, you know, they were talking about display and they were saying that it's great as a reminder, particularly of an ad that you've seen on TV. And for me, that's what you know. You often get with an Outstream unit, it's like a reminder. I don't necessarily pause what I'm reading and click, oh, I'll turn on the sound. You know, I have done that before, but it's quite rare for me to do it. But it certainly, you know, it acts as a reminder, I think, of an ad I might have seen elsewhere. Or it can sort of give you a very quick snapshot of a car looking very nice and a logo, and that there is some sort of impact from that, I'm sure, even if the sound is off. So moving on to CTV. So what exactly does Unruly offer in the CTV world?
So basically, Unruly is, as I said, is a multi-format SSP that enables clients to execute their video campaigns across those many formats, as I said, from mobile in-app video all the way through to CTV and OTT. And the way that it works is the same as it does with in-stream video or your standard video that you would buy across any current media owner's inventory. It enables if you like, it brings the ability for any advertiser or any agency to harness the potential and the power of CTV and OTT app inventory as part of their mainstream media campaigns. And so if you think about the ecosystem today, you've got probably 30% of the ecosystem is sitting with BVOD or broadcast video on demand, which is understandably, they make that a closed garden or a walled garden, I should say. And then you have SVOD or subscription video on demand. Well, by the nature, they're not going to take advertising because people are paying to have their services. And that's probably another, say, 30 to 40% of the market. So you're really looking at being able to buy the other 30% or so at scale with the help of partners and, as I said, scaled SSPs, companies like Unruly, that enable the ease and access of that inventory to be done as part of everyday campaigns. Now, the challenge is, does that involve the TV teams? Does that involve the audiovisual teams, or does that involve the digital teams, or does it involve a hybrid of all three? But the real premise is to basically bring the scale, the targeting capabilities, and the authenticity of linear TV to digital.
And do you think, where's the supply going to come from? I mean, a lot of people will question that, you know, whether, you know, there's going to be much outside of, you know, YouTube and the broadcasters, you know, how much supply is there going to be? I'm an optimist on this front. It reminds me very much of the early days of online video when people were skeptical about whether online video would work at all. I remember when I first started the site, people would ask me all the time, you know, will it scale? Can it work? You know, it's too hard, you know, for people to do, and that kind of thing. What's your feeling? Where's the sort of new sources of CTV supply going to come from?
Well, I think the supply, the best thing around the growth of smart TVs and smart devices is there's always an increasing level of or number of consumers. With increasing consumers, there will always be the ability to provide and deliver content, because that's how media owners are going to drive their numbers and build their own consumer bases. So it will come from those partners who have apps or content or distribution via smart devices. And it will come from the OTT platforms that are placed on those smart devices and have cut deals with OEMs, that it comes pre-installed. And think of anyone who has a Samsung TV or an LG TV or any form of smart TV today, you will have a certain amount of pre-installed apps on there that you can then set up with your own login details, or you can download via its internet connection, install on your TV and have access that way. So the what we found over the last 12 to 18 months is the volume is growing. It's the accessibility that needs to be refined. And also, it's still quite a fragmented media in that, you know, there's only certain places and certain parts of the ecosystem that are able to capture data. The OEMs can capture data through their ACR and through their HDMI cable connections, for example, and that gives you a certain volume of data. You then have you have the platforms, think Roku or Spring or anything like that, that will carry the data. And then you have the actual OTT and the apps themselves. So the ecosystem is definitely growing because there's more and more people consuming. And I think if you look at any form of research, certainly towards the back end of 2020 and early 21, when Unruly did some research, there is an argument to say that most people will limit their subscription-based options to one or two partners. And by most, I mean somewhere in the region of 60%. And say they're going to go and look to consume more ad-funded options, because clearly there isn't necessarily the disposable income to have multiple subscriptions. And so the growth area will come from the the fact that consumers are moving and taking more interest in having their content delivered in that way. And that's where the media owners, the content providers are going to go. You've only got to look at the investment in content that companies like Amazon, Apple, Netflix have made in their own branded content or their own actual created content in order to entice and keep consumers onto their platforms.
Yeah, and I would argue that it seems quite likely a lot of them will introduce some form of advertising at some point in the future. We're very much going through the early days when it's all about, you know, winning audience share, winning other consumers and getting additional subscribers on your platform. You know, it's almost like the days of Facebook when Facebook didn't run ads, or, you know, so many of these platforms, the various social platforms, for example, that, you know, don't run ads at the beginning, so often say they'll never run ads, and then eventually you have to find growth somewhere. And advertising is always the easy one to switch on. So what's your experience? I mean, you mentioned with selling to agencies, that thing of the fragmentation across various teams, is that still a problem today? You know, agencies will often be, oh no, we've got our unified AV team. And then, you know, in reality, behind the doors, you hear that, yeah, this is still a massive problem, that agencies are just very siloed and segmented and portioned out into, yeah, their own little teams.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it's the perception against the reality, really, isn't it? I mean, the reality is that this is still relatively new. Everyone's still trying to find their feet. And brands are still trying to understand where they get the maximum value. And because of that, it's not necessarily clear to the agencies as to how they're going to address this and how they should be structured. And some agencies are making, as I said, taking the hybrid option. Some agencies are saying, well, actually, it's a case of if a client wishes to move into multi-format video, then it's the digital team. If a client wants to move into the whole advanced TV and look at CTV and OTT, then it's the hybrid team, or it's a specialist department that is specifically there for advanced TV. The one thing that doesn't seem to be clear or obvious to the market is if there's any change going the other way, as in the TV traditional TV teams are changing their structure. It seems more like certain people with certain skill sets are transferring into new teams. And so I think it's a case of we all have to move with an open mind and be flexible on how we cover the market and how the market wants to be dealt with.
Yeah, and I think it's also probably, you know, in Europe certainly a reflection of, you know, the market needs to mature a little bit before, you know, it starts to take over teams. I know there's people like Finecast who are, you know, have that sort of dedicated unit focus on addressable TV in all its forms. But I think I think there's going to be more Finecast in the future is what I'm saying. Okay, so when it comes to, you know, CTV, is there any one problem that, you know, if you could get rid of this problem tomorrow, what would that problem be?
Oh, that's a good question. I think, like with any new medium, it has growing pains, and therefore, I think the one thing we should, there is no real one thing. I think there's a combination of things that are all interlinked because it's technology, and therefore, you know, you throw the stone in the pond, and the ripples have far-reaching effects, and so it would be around. I guess it's around the ability to target, report, and understand what the end action would be. So I guess what I'm trying to say is it's the ability to target, review, and then analyze the results. So, yeah, target, review, results.
Yeah, testing to, yeah. Is there any sort of movement, is there any sort of convincing solutions when it comes to things like attribution? Are you seeing anything yet, or is this still, are we still, do you just need to get the basics right first?
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to get the basics right first in terms of how we target and who we target. What's the what's being passed from the content owners via the bid stream for platforms like Unruly to understand how they can target, what's available to target. And you're talking about things like content targeting, genre targeting, you know, is it horror? Therefore, does that equal adult 18 plus and all these kind of options? So there's an interesting aspect there. But the one thing that that I think has to be remembered is if you don't get into it now, where everyone's in a test and learn phase, you kind of come late to the party. It then has the potential to be less cost effective for you because you don't have the learnings and you don't have the understanding. And in order to get to that stage, you do have to do a bit of test and learn, refine. And you do have to understand that just because you are buying a certain piece of content, it doesn't mean you're getting access to all the consumers that are having that are consuming that content, because they could be across different platforms. You know, they could be accessing it through an app that's directly on their smart device, but they could then also be accessing it through an OTT platform that delivers to their smart device. And the two pieces of inventory, yes, the content's the same, but the two pieces of inventory and the data around that inventory is collected and harnessed and packaged differently. So there's still an element of fragmentation that the market needs to understand, and there needs to be a level of standardization that the market needs to understand and agree upon in order to, I guess, really kind of have that full turnkey solution that maybe some of the brands who are still tentatively looking at addressable TV, they need to feel comfortable about before they fully invest.
Yeah. So the final question that I ask people every week. So if you had $10 million to invest today, I'd always say, let's make it pounds. Come on, we'll give you a bump. where would you invest it and why?
Joe, interestingly, I think I would invest. I would do two investments. One would be, and they are interlinked, around the whole metaverse and augmented reality. I think that's an interesting area that I think brands can answer a lot of their own questions and be a bit more control of who's accessing or is being addressed by their brand, but also into esports. I think esports is a very exciting area that brands are yet to fully embrace. You know, it's still a multi-billion dollar industry, but it could be so much more, because if you look at the current generation of teenagers, you look at the current set of millennials and post-millennials, there is such a large following. I mean, some of these esports teams are packing out 40, 50, 60,000 seat stadiums for what is tomorrow's adult consumer, and indeed probably the age demographic, I think, raises up to around 35. So anyone from 15, 16 up to 35. So, yeah, I think I would look to invest in that, because I think that's going to be a huge area for brands, particularly those in FMCG and service-related brands, finance, etc. I think that's an area that's going to become increasingly more important.
Yeah, it's... Yeah, I know somebody who's working for a motorsport esports company, and one of the things that they're doing is combining the real world of motorsport and having, you know, the actual Formula One drivers taking part in the esports side of things. So, you know, if you're a Formula One fan and you're sort of relatively starved of content, you know, between the different races, this is something that you can engage in. And I think as the games sort of evolve and become more and more realistic, it's you know, they're almost cinematic in the way that they're designed. Sometimes they're better than what you'd see in the cinema. I think that, yeah, that there is huge potential for growth in that area.
I think the prizes on offer, so some of these teams are very professional. If you make the team, and I think a team is between 5 and 8 people, some of these guys are earning $500,000 a year base salary plus win bonuses, very much like professional sportsmen and women. And I think the audiences they attract, you know, you look at something, some of these more popular influencers on Twitch, and they're attracting tens of millions of people watching them gaming on live streams. And I think that whole area of esports live streaming, I think that's worth an investment. And with certainly a good amount of the £10 million you're very graciously giving me, Vincent. I think it's going to become increasingly important over the next few years. And you just got to look at the growth of the number of teams in terms of the cities and countries in the world that are producing professional esport teams that have full sponsorship packages, have large following audiences. You know, there are several teams in Asia where they have anywhere from 50 to 60 million followers. What brand doesn't want to tap into that kind of importance and that kind of consumer following? I think it's a given that will become more interesting, and especially if you're able to harness the established sports. I mean, if you look at the Grand Prix season, what is it, 21, 22 races, a couple of weeks in between each one, or certainly a week in between each race, plus a mid-season break. So what do the drivers do? Well, maybe they do drive on the esports circuit, and that will attract a huge amount of following, and that opens up doors for several of their sponsors. So, yeah, I mean, look at the popularity of the electronic Formula One. Again, I think the possibilities are endless, and that would be an area that I think would be worth investing in.
Yep. Well, Alex, thanks so much for taking the time. Really much appreciated. And it looks like we're actually going to see a lot more of each other in person this year than we have for the last couple of years. I'm going out there with a bold prediction. My feeling is that, yeah, onwards and upwards, and we're all going to be back in rooms together this year. It feels like I'm always conscious that I sound like an anti-vaxxer when I'm being optimistic, but I'm feeling very optimistic about the coming year. So yeah, hope to see you in person soon.
Fantastic, appreciate it. Thank you very much, Vincent.